Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Navigating budget limitations, staff retention, and how to keep employees engaged makes human resources people like Sisyphus rolling that stone uphill. Plus, they've got to deal with newfangled initiatives like skills-based and early career hiring. One agency is getting the hang of recruitment and retention. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman got the story from the acting chief human capital officer at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Eric Dilworth.
One of the first things we have to focus on, are, along with hiring new employees, whether to fill positions within the human capital office. You know, we need as many folks in operation area staffing, operational area, because we weren't filling a lot of jobs externally anyway. So we need to get the right HR skills within Otico. So we've been concentrating on that for the last couple of years. And that is, we're here in the capital region, and it's really competitive finding seasoned HR folks is competitive with all the agencies. So we've with bringing on many new people, and you talk about retention, one of the main things about retention is continue to provide experience building opportunities for our current employees and also training. So we've been really, identifying a lot of rotational opportunities where employees can go get other experiences that, can enhance their career. And just, enhance their interest at remaining at NRC. And then training, making sure we're providing the right training for people to be proficient at their jobs. And then also leadership training that, give people those folks who do want to move into the leadership realm, give them the right skills to do that. So, it's outreach, it's taking care of our current employees, and getting the right skills to meet the mission.
You bring up a lot of really interesting points there, and things that I definitely have heard from other agencies, talking about recruiting for HR positions at the same time that you're trying to bring in other skills. And, I guess I want to ask you about the retention aspect of it, if we could dive a little bit deeper there. You mentioned training for employees, rotational opportunities. How often do you see employees taking advantage of those types of flexibilities? And are there other things that you notice make people want to stay with the agency for the long haul?
Talking about the training first, we do training surveys where employees can identify the type of training they would like, whether it's, skills training for their current career field, or if it's some other kind of type of training that would disenhance them as an overall federal employee. So we have a good budget for that. So that's the way we really, and also with leadership identifying critical training needs. And that's, we have a technical training center that does all of our, different training for the nuclear experts in our career field, and bring them there to, basically enhance their job qualifications to perform their work. But retention goes, our retention numbers are equal or a little bit less than the average for federal agencies. But with that, if you see anyone leaving, and it seems to be a trend, you want to retain as much talent you can in the agency. So that's really gets down to the culture of an agency. That, I find that people remain at an agency or an organization because, they enjoy the work, first of all, but then they also, in the culture of that organization, a culture that makes people want to say they feel valued, they feel like their work is valued. So we have, it's not in Otico, but the agency has a culture team and a lead for that been doing a lot of work on that in the last year. And that's where we hope to see, continued increased retention of NRC employees.
And when you're looking at something like culture, How do you measure that? Are there different surveys or different ways that you ask employees how they feel about the work setting? And, you know, what are some of the data points that you look at for that?
Yeah, and I want to first say I'm not the expert in culture, but we do, as a leader, we all use Know the Fail survey. That's a starting point. And then, you know, feedback from your members of your organization. And the culture team, I think they are, you know, putting together additional surveys. But no, you do start with the FAB survey and then this interaction with the workforce to understand challenges and barriers to whether it's job satisfaction or other issues that they could be dealing with.
You touched on this a little bit already, but were there specific factors of FEVs that you're looking at this year to try to improve?
There are, I think, employee engagement, communication are always, you know, high on that list because, you know, the better we communicate, whether it's communicating changes in an organization, communicating, you know, what's going on with the organization, different initiatives, and ensuring that information is available to the workforce. That's one of the challenges, to make sure you do that consistently and at a high level. And workload management is always an issue. So from a Chico point of view, the better we can do at training people, providing training, better we can do it filling vacancies in a timely manner. That helps with the overall culture because people know the jobs are filled. We fill them with the right skill sets. That helps everyone to be able to execute their job better and for everyone to be successful.
I want to talk a little bit more about recruitment as well. So you mentioned earlier on, just a few minutes ago, that you guys go to college campuses. So is early career hiring a priority for NRC, and can you talk a little bit about some of the strategies that you have specifically for recruiting those just at the start of their career?
Yes, I mean, that is always having early career people on board to be trained and get the experience as they go through and be able to replace, you know, our knowledge folks that are eventually going to retire, you know. So having that type of program in place is key. One such program that we have is our NRAN program, Nuclear Regulator Apprenticeship Network. We bring in about 25 entry level, mostly engineers, and over about an 18 months, 2 years, and we keep this program going continuously. They're trained, they go out on rotational assignments to the different regions. So after their 2 years, they have gained a lot of experience, and then they're placed in a permanent position throughout the agency. It could be at headquarters, or it could be at one of the four regions. So that's one unique program that we have. On top of that, we have a big summer hire program, and then from that, many of those students then may go into co-op positions and that type of thing.
One other priority that the administration has had for a couple of years, even going back to the previous administration, has been on skills-based hiring. Is that something that comes into play, whether that's in conjunction with early career hiring or something that NRC is trying to do more broadly?
I think that's something that you focus on all the time, because you can't just base the hiring on certain degrees or just certain experience. With a lot of our positions, it's a combination of having certain degree requirements as far as that's what's needed to perform the duties of the jobs, but also what skills do we need, you know, the background we need. So we do skills hiring. No, that's where we target. It may be certain conferences that we go and recruit at because those skill sets are at that conference, or certain colleges that we that we target. But we try to, you know, whether it's historically Black colleges and universities, all universities across the nation, as much as we can. You know, you don't have a budget to do everything you want to do, but we do get out to all types of universities. But based on, do they have the type of skills and degrees that we're targeting? We can always get better at it, but we do strategic workforce planning where we identify our critical skills, and that's what we try to tie our recruitment to. And, you know, of course, that's a lot of the engineers, whether people will be resident inspectors out at the different nuclear sites, whether it's people working program and policy issues, but they need a nuclear background. All of those things we do we know. I consider that, you know, skills targeted recruitment.
As you mentioned earlier as well, is HR part of that mix as well for trying to focus on specific skills?
We are. I mean, you know, not just finding people who can be what we call staffing specialists, where they do the recruitment and processing those actions, issuing hiring certificates. But depending, you know, we have the wide gamut of, you know, HR skills needed in our organization, from HR analysts who, you know, do a lot of analytics for us, our training experts, our policy people, labor who does the union negotiation. So it's you know, we target all of those depending on the need, and we have a need in a lot of those areas. The other thing we're, you know, starting to look at is for our own career field, for, you know, human resources, you know, building that bench, you know, having HR trainees per se, where we're building the bench. That's something we haven't done a lot of in this office, but that's something we're looking at moving to.
What are the types of trainings that either employees are most looking for or that NRC is most seeking to try to build skills?
It really depends on your job. If you're a regulator or inspector out there at the different locations, now we have simulators, so that those simulators, they go through that training where they become familiar with what they would be looking at on a day-to-day basis when they're back, you know, at their site. But the other training, you know, it goes the full realm. It could be something that it could be a policy person, and by going to a certain specific training, it's going to help them better understand the type of regulations they're working with, have that insight. And currency is another thing, being current with what's going on in the nuclear field. So it's really a wide gamut. But as I said before, a lot of the ways we obtain what people are looking for us through our, you know, we do it twice a year, our external training survey, where people can identify the type of training. Not everything fits, you know, it needs to be job related or some enhancement to to an employee's federal career. So we try to, you know, balance that, where, you know, we ensure that, you know, people are getting the training so that they're qualified and to do their job, but also there's other career development opportunities and training that folks are looking for.
And just one other aspect of whether it's recruitment or retention that I definitely want to touch on is this idea of hybrid work and the hybrid workforce. I know there's been a lot of shifts lately with agencies in terms of teleworking or working in person, but how does hybrid work and those types of flexibilities affect recruitment and retention? Is that something that you consider when you're looking at building out some of these long-term strategies?
We do have a hybrid work environment, some telework, and then, you know, in-office requirement also. So it's really about educating the potential applicants on what our hybrid workforce is. You know, we still value interaction of the workforce. The most thing is, are we completing the mission with this hybrid workforce? And I say we are highly productive. We have a very dedicated workforce. Folks want to do a great job, want to succeed, but I also want to see the agency succeed. So, you know, the hybrid workforce, I see it as a positive and has been a positive for NRC. And it's a balance of everything out there with the different federal agencies. But we believe that, you know, our hybrid workforce works. We're executing the mission, and we're able to recruit people to come into this environment.
Eric Dilworth, Acting Chief Human Capital Officer at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, speaking with Federal News Network's Drew Friedman. Check out Drew's story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.